irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host today, Alan Cardoza, and unfortunately, my articulate and handsome co-host, Marvin Smith, cannot be with us today as he's making a positive difference in the life of one young man. As usual, we will bring guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Each week, we will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, with each of us having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and authors sharing valuable stories and helpful information who are working to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. And we'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, 30 years ago, our guest today, Kathy Ketchum, started writing about addiction, and she got hooked. On writing, that is. The more research she did, and the more she wrote about the subject, the more impassioned she became. Kathy has now co-authored 15 books, 11 on the subject of drugs, addiction, and recovery. And her books have sold more than 1.3 million copies, which fits perfectly with our topic today, experiencing spirituality and finding meaning through storytelling. Now, a great master once said, the shortest distance between a human being and truth is a story. And in her book, Experiencing Spirituality, Kathy and her co-author, Ernest Kurtz, take readers on a journey through storytelling as a means of self-discovery, recounting and interpreting great wisdom stories from all ages and all cultures, as well as telling many of their own. The authors shed light on such experiences as awe, wonder, humor, confusion, and forgiveness. William Moyers, the New York Times best-selling author of Broken, calls it the inspiring storyteller's guide to who we are as humans and how we can live the reality of our own dreams along the journey of an unpredictable life. Kathy, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much, Alan. It's good to be here.
Well, it is very nice to have you. I've had a chance to read some of your books, and it was great when Jan told me that we were getting you on the show. I thought, you know, I believe that I read some of your books in the 90s. So now I'm not trying to date anybody, but just understand that, you know, I've always been very interested in the subject. Because I've been working with at-risk youth, anything that I could read that would help educate me on how to work with these young people, I thought was a huge benefit to me and to the young people I was working with. So thank you for taking your time and writing these books that have helped so many families.
You're so welcome, and I love to tell people that I wrote my first book when I was 5 years old.
There you go. See? So.
There you go.
I love it. So I think one of the things that a lot of people think about, when they're choosing a book or when they're picking up a book is, you know, right. What motivated you? I mean, at one point in the time before you started on this journey of writing these many books, what motivated mm-hmm. you to start writing on this subject?
You know, I was a freelance writer, and I had this passion to write, but I wasn't sure exactly what my subject was. So I was so happy to land a part-time job at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which is a newspaper, still exists. And I was the secretary to the editor. So a lot of writers start with that sort of, you know, secondary service position. We waitress, we do all sorts of things. Anyway, Bill would tell me, Bill Asbury, who is a great friend, would tell me about his experiences as a recovering alcoholic. And I couldn't, there was something about the way he described the way he used to be that didn't fit with the way he was now. So I was fascinated by that. I was fascinated by who was this man when he was drinking and using, and who was this man that I knew when he was clean and sober. So I wanted to find out about that. And I, the really interesting aspect of this is I had absolutely no experience with addiction. I didn't have it in my family. I'd never seen it. My father had a very good friend who was an alcoholic, but I knew him only in recovery. And he was a beautiful, beautiful human being. So there was something about that transformation that fascinated me, the way, you know, the way they used to be, what happened, and the way they are now. I was just totally taken by that. So I wanted to understand it. So I started researching and writing articles about it, and I got hooked.
Well, I know in one of the books that I read, which was The Spirituality of Imperfection, and I think that was published in the early 90s, and the just published Experiencing Spirituality, you and your co-author, again, as I mentioned, Ernest Kurtz, you write about the power of stories to heal and make whole. So how is your story as a person who, you know, I know that you shared some of your stories in these books, but share with some of the listeners, how writing about addiction and recovery and spirituality linked to your son's story.
You know, Alan, that's such a complicated story, but I'll do my best. When Ben was 3 years old, he's my youngest. I have three children, and he's my baby. So when he was 3 years old, I started working on The Spirituality of Imperfection with Ernie Kurtz, the brilliant, amazing, wonderful Ernie Kurtz. How lucky was I to meet this man? Oh, my gosh. Anyway, he taught me about Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 Steps, as the modern-day expression of ancient spiritual traditions, you know, from Christianity to Hasidic Judaism, Taoism, Sufism, Buddhism, and all of those traditions focused on imperfection. And he told me about stories. He taught me about the power of stories to heal and make whole. Now, this was all new to me. I'm not a really religious person. I believe, I have faith, but I'm not sure what I, you know, I'm a quester, I'm a seeker, and I found with Ernie that I could seek and quest as much as I wanted, and that was okay. So let me get back to how Ben worked into that. So when he was in middle school, I started to volunteer at the Juvenile Justice Center. I had three children, and I thought, this is perfect. You know, it's a perfect time for me to look into this new world. And I wanted to be in the trenches with the kids. I wanted to understand what they were going through, and to talk to them about the risks of using drugs and maybe to help them get into treatment and recovery programs. But I tell you, having written a book on addiction back in, I joke about this, back in 1981, it was published in 1981. I joke about the fact that I was, you know, what did I tell you, five? I was 7 years old. But I couldn't believe the depth and the breadth of the drug problems in these young children. At 11 and 12 years old, they were late stage alcoholics, late stage. And it just, as I mean, this is a cliche, but it blew my socks off. I thought, how did a disease that used to take decades to progress now take months or years? So, and then I witnessed it with my own son, and then I wrote a book on adolescent addiction that opened my eyes to a whole new way of looking at the problem.
Right. Now, wasn't that one entitled, what, Teens Under the Influence?
Right, right. And that was published when Ben was 16, 17 years old. And he had started using marijuana and alcohol in middle school. And by the way, I just want to let people know that I have his absolute permission to tell his story. He knows how much stories work to affect people, to change their minds, to help them know that they're not alone. So, anyway.
Right. Ben, well, And one of the things, too, I think to add, because everybody that listens to this show knows that I love stories, and I love stories with happy endings, you know, but one of the things is that, you know, as you talk about Ben, I mean, he went on to become the academic director at Muirwood Teen Boys Adolescent Treatment Center, so he took what he learned, and he went on to help other young people, you know, which... Yeah. You know, which is just, you know, a part of a beautiful journey.
It, you know, Alan, it is, but I tell you, we were so, I have to say this, I feel like we were so lucky, because I work with families, and I see their pain, and I work with families who have lost their children to addiction, and I know that they're, but for the grace of God, whatever, go I. So my that sense of connecting with everyone through this, through our stories, through the stories that we tell about our children and our lives and our own selves, and they connect us, and they make us feel not so alone. So I just feel such gratitude for the fact that we were able to emerge from this very, very, very difficult, awful, terrible, no good. I don't know how many adjectives to put to it, but anybody who has a child who is suffering and their family is suffering as a result of that knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, I mean, let's talk a little bit more about how stories are related to recovery. How it's such an intricate part of a person's recovery is to be able to almost cleanse themselves by being able to go into these stories that either make them not feel alone or feel like they can see the light at the end of the tunnel. There's so many ways in which stories can help, but share with us some of the ways in which you know, you've addressed it in your books.
Stories are so amazing in terms of both their sort of general impact and their specific impact. So, I, you know, sometimes I'll read a story and I'll think it'll just kind of fly past me, and I'll think, well, what was that about? And then suddenly it'll fly back to me, and it will say, well, listen to me. And so there's something about these stories that has this powerful impact. And let me see if I can give you an example. And this is a little bit, you know, apart from the kind of stories that we tell in experiencing spirituality. But I have a family support group, so I started a Trilogy Recovery Community, which is a peer support organization, nonprofit organization. We don't charge for what we do, but we welcome families, we welcome kids. At first we thought we'd be 12 to 18 year olds that we would work with, and now we work with kids up to 40, and we work with older adults as well. So we had this family support group, and four new people happened to come this one day, two couples, and one of the women was just in tears. She just was crying and talking about what was happening, and we were all crying with her. We were passing the Kleenex. That's how we describe it. We passed the Kleenex. And the woman next to her, who was also new, was leaning toward her in the most amazing way. I mean, just like hanging on every word. And when the first person finished her story, the second woman said, "You just told me my story. You just told me the story I was going to tell tonight." And in that moment, they were healed, because there's an old Hasidic story that says when a person comes to you and tells your own story, you are healed. And that, I tell you, I listened to that and I had shivers up and down. Uh-huh. I was like, they found each other through those stories. It was really stunning.
Well, and I couldn't agree more. And I think part of that is, at that moment, that second person realized, I'm not alone. I'm not the only one going through this. And I think that is just so beneficial. And so many of these, these beautiful programs that are out there, they get that. They get the concept, and they call it different things. And some will call it RAP, and some will call it forum or discussion or group or whatever. There can be a different word for it, but in each case it is exactly what you're talking about. They're getting together and they're telling stories, and by telling stories they are unifying themselves as a group.
That stories are the most powerful thing in the whole world, I think. I mean, we sort of learn that as children with the fairy tales that we're told, but it's absolutely true as we grow older, too, is that as we tell each other our stories, we're healed.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about, again, your newest book, which is Experiencing Spirituality.
Yeah.
I think in this book, more so than some of your others, you rely really heavily on the stories to convey the experiences of spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, the tying it into spirituality.
You know, some experiences are really, truly impossible to describe with mere words. So how do I explain how I feel when I drive down a street and I see an older couple holding hands, or to be a little bit trite about it, but the moon rise, or just birds, there's the birds in this huge flock just turning all at once. So how do we tell those experiences? How do we explain those experiences? We tell them through stories. and we rely on stories as a vehicle to communicate what we can't speak or put into words. So they lead us to see and somehow understand what lies. And we love this word, Ernie and I love this word, beyond words. So
sure.
What lies beyond words, beyond experience? And I think stories take us there.
Mm-hmm. Well, now let's talk about these kind of experiences, because we know that, I mean, we can have positive experiences, we can have negative experiences, we can have things that we believe are spiritual experiences, and we can have things that we may not believe it was necessarily spiritual. So mm-hmm. let's talk about the kind of experiences.
Well, gosh, how many experiences are there? So in Experiencing Spirituality, the book that I just wrote with Ernie, which I love, by the way, I open that book up and I read it every day, and it teaches me. I actually opened it up the other day and I wrote, every time I open this up, I find something new. And I must have read this book 50 times. So anyway, we explore 16 different spiritual experiences, including wonder, community, listening, forgiveness, humor, memory, wisdom, prayer. And those experiences are, well, what we write about is those experiences are what we need to pay attention to. So the great philosopher, psychologist William James wrote once that my experience is what I agree to attend to. So mm-hmm. I thought about that recently. I was on a vacation with my sisters and our daughters. We do call it a mother-daughter reunion that we do every year. And I was walking down the beach, and I was full of these thoughts about, God, I have so much to do for this book, and I can't, what am I going to, you know, the deadline is coming up, and I was just totally preoccupied with that. And suddenly I just stopped in my tracks and I thought about what William James said, my experience is what I agree to attend to. And I thought, this is what I'm experiencing as I walk this beach, is the stress and the drama and the deadline and all that stuff. And I thought, I don't want to do that. I don't want mm-hmm. to do that. I want to pay attention to the waves and to the beach and to the birds and to the people. So that helped me. That helped me.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it makes perfect sense. What you attend to, you know, I would see as what you focus on. And
yes.
And if you start focusing on the stress, then you're focusing on maybe the person you believe that's bringing the stress on you. And so instead of focusing on that, maybe you decide to focus on the forgiveness of whatever it is that yeah. they did that that you feel is bringing the stress on, you know, or, you know, or again, like you said, or focusing on humor, or mm-hmm. you know, focusing on the wisdom, the wisdom that we learned from that experience that we're saying is stressing us out.
Right.
Right. So. Yeah, I mean, I think
I like
that's
what you said, Alan, if it's okay. I'm sorry I interrupted
sure.
you there.
No, please.
But
go
I
right
love
ahead.
What you said about humor, because we get so gall darn serious, don't we? And there's something about humor that I feel that we bring up in the new book that and in our first book together, Experiencing Spirituality. But we have to laugh at ourselves. We're mm-hmm. we're human. You know, we're put together funny. We're not perfect. I mean, there's a great story about, and I'll use the word God here, and I know that mm-hmm. some people are believers and some are perhaps not, but God looked at his creation of human beings, and he said, oops. Which is, you know, we're put together funny. We're human beings, and we can't achieve perfection. You know, we're not God. So, you know, that's a great truth that Ernie Kurtz gave to me.
Well, and I think you're right on target that, I mean, humor, you know, as they say, you know, can be the best medicine. And it truly can be that, you know, in working with people at times that are going through very, very difficult times or very difficult situations, and, you know, to be able to find something appropriately where you can apply humor to it,
right,
seems to be one, you know, part of the medicine that helps us, you know, take that heavy thing of stress or that heavy thing that's weighing on us, to be able to take that off, and, you know, stop and laugh at ourselves or you know, find humor in something that it just gives us that little bit of time to remove ourselves from whatever it was that was bothering us. So, yeah, I couldn't
Absolutely.
Agree more.
Absolutely, Alan. And I have to tell you that our family support group that we have at Trilogy Recovery Community, which is a nonprofit organization that that I founded several years ago, but we'll tell our stories, and they are sad, often desperate, and profoundly grieving stories. And we'll find that we laugh. We see, you know, we don't laugh at the story, but there's some release that happens when we laugh together, which is, I mean, I find it quite astonishing. We also cry together. We pass the Kleenex, and we have those moments of really deep grieving, but we laugh together, and that sort of takes us beyond our own individual problems into the sort of humor of, you know, the humorous tragedy. Tragic humor of the human race. So,
well, I think what I'd like to do, let's take a break. And again, for those of you that are listening, if you want to learn a little bit more about the book we're talking about, you can go to Kathy's website. It is www.experiencingspirituality.com. You know, you can go, you can check it out. You can just open up another, you know, another window on your computer. Obviously, if you're driving, you don't want to do this. But, you know, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back, and we will continue talking with Kathy Ketchum.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and our topic today is experiencing spirituality, finding meaning through storytelling. Our guest is Kathy Ketchum, and Kathy, we were talking a little bit about, again, your latest book, which is Experiencing Spirituality, and I realized that, I mean, one of the things that I had read in one of your books that and you and Ernie had touched on it, and then you write about spirituality, and you talk about how it's ordinary and how it's everyday. And that's one of the things that I like, because we want to get away from the fact that if it's spirituality, you have to somehow go to a building, you have to go to a church, you have to go to a synagogue, like you have to go somewhere else. And I'm of the belief you don't have to do that. So talk a little bit about, you know, the fact where you talk about the fact it's ordinary and it's everyday.
Yes. I think absolutely that's it. You know, often we think that we have to go to a church or we have to reserve spirituality for Sunday, or, you know, it's something sort of reserved for the mountaintop, the guru who can, you know, go up to the mountaintop. And I think that it happens to us in each moment, or in so many moments of every day. So I think what Ernie Kurtz has taught me, and he is just, you know, I am so lucky to have written these books with him. He is the brilliant one. I like to say that he's the brilliant one, and I sort of have latched on to his the tail feathers of his kite. And but he's taught me that spirituality is, in its briefest description, a way of life, a way of being, and again, a way that we be. And that way of being is experienced in our listening, in the way that we be quiet, and we open ourselves to the experience of others without that desire to fix things, you know, to take over the conversation and say, oh, yeah, you think that was bad? which we so often find ourselves doing, but we just sit there and we listen. And it's also experienced in our confusion, in the way we wrestle with our own imperfections or the imperfections of others. In the way we struggle to be in control, to be right, to have the last word. And then when we feel, you know, dissatisfied, unhappy, and confused because we simply don't have those answers. So we just don't know. And it's the not knowing, I think, that leaves us open to mystery and to possibilities.
Right. Now, I also noticed, I mean, that the stories you tell in your book are not really the, you know, chicken soup for the soul kind of feel-good variety. How are they different? And, I mean, share with us some of your favorite stories.
Oh, that's a great question, or series of questions. Think of these stories as treasures that contain within them further mysteries. They unfold. So many of these stories, I have to admit, when I first read them, I didn't get them. It was like, oh, you know, what does that mean? I'm not sure what that means. So, for example, there was a story that we actually didn't included in the spirituality of imperfection. We put it in the notes. And I remember going back to it and thinking, gosh, that story is pretty important. Why did we put it in the notes? So the story is that a student asks the rabbi, why is the stork classed in the scriptures as one of the unclean birds when it gives so much love to its mate and its young? And the rabbi answered, because it gives love only to its own. And I kept thinking about that story. I kept thinking about it. Then it came to me in real life. I watched a friend of mine who was the most loving father, but he was not loving to other children. He was harsh with them. He was strong with them. He was even mean to them. And I thought, he loves his children. He told me later, he said, I love my children, but I don't love children very much over. Also, that story flew back at me, and I swear, I tell you, these stories have wings. They come to you when you least expect them, and they come to you especially if you're not exactly sure what they mean, because they have to keep bugging you. They have to keep saying, "Okay, I do have meaning. I do have I do have something to teach." And so I imagine that story is sort of sitting on my shoulder, sort of whispering to me. And what I heard from the story was that compassion and kindness and love can't be reserved just for the people who are in our families, for our own blood. Our families are much bigger than our own blood. So that's what that story taught me.
And you know what I'd like to share is that, and I agree with I get that also from the story, but I get something else too, and that is the looking at it from the other side, and that is to be careful how we judge.
Yes.
Because you may have a situation to where, you know, you have somebody, and because they're doing so much, they're, you know, as far as they're helping others and stuff, and in a brief period of time that you see them with their own kids, and something comes up and they kind of rush through it or whatever, you know, be careful how we judge. You know, if somebody's, oh, well, you know, that person doesn't provide time for others or whatever, well, maybe they do. Maybe they just want their children to, you know, to learn and understand that, you know, you do for a lot of people if you can, you know, that, you know, so, you know, I'm saying there's, it's kind of learning where the balance is and everything else. So yeah, that's, I think, one of the beauties of stories is that everybody can grasp different things from it. But at the same time, it's usually going to be something that's going to make you better by learning that.
And I love that we don't judge, because I think once, especially people who, you know, have had their children go through this experience of drug use and addiction, our hearts, you would never choose this life. You would never choose this life for your child or for yourself or for your family. But our hearts, what happens is you realize that this experience has changed you. So you will never, never, ever judge another human being the way you might have beforehand. So there's something powerful about, incredibly powerful about that story. And what I see with the men and women I work with in the family support group at Trilogy Recovery Community is they want to help. They feel a call to service, which is such a stunning, you know, and many of these people, some of them have lost their children, and they want to be there for other people who may be in danger of losing their children. This disease of addiction is horrific, and what it does to kids and what it does to families is, if you have not experienced it, again, that word experience, if you have not gone through it, you don't know it, and you can sit and you can sit in judgment of those parents, and you can say, oh my gosh, it's, you know, it's the parents' fault. Well, how many parents are there who love their children to the ends of the earth, and who have been great parents, who have candlelight tuna fish dinners like we used to have, and who have been through this really, really terrible disease. It just, you know, it opens your heart and your soul in a really beautiful way.
Well, and there's I mean, case after case after case that shows, you know, that where addiction's involved. I mean, you can have, you know, parents who have raised four children, and you know, and you know, one went on to, you know, to Harvard to become a great doctor, and one goes on to somewhere and becomes, you know, a person working for the Peace Corps, helping people in other countries, and you know, on and on, and then. And then one who struggles with addiction, and that one might be the smartest of all of them, but it doesn't mean that you know, that the parents have somehow failed. It just means that, you know, this person needs to identify this, needs to work with it, and in many cases they go on to become some of the greatest people we know. So
absolutely. Absolutely. One of the saddest things about addiction, it seems to me, is if I had a child with cancer, I would get all the medical help I could get. I would, you know, I would have people sending me flowers and making me dinners and sending cards and visiting us in the hospital. When you have addiction in your family, people don't do that. They keep their distance. They're afraid to say anything. And so the loneliness of this disease is so horrific. And also the fact, you know, to try to get treatment for your child costs an arm and a leg, and it should be free. I really believe take all the money that we put into the drug wars and stuff, you know, trying to fight the cartels, and just say, we're going to help our kids get well. And I honestly, it's just, we're totally backwards. And the reason I'm so passionate about that is I've been involved with this field for 35 years, and we've gone backwards. We've gone backwards. We used to have more treatment. We used to have better treatment. I mean, there are places that offer the absolute best treatment. Muir Wood is one. Sundown Ranch is one. Betty Ford, Hazleton, Karen. There's fabulous treatment centers, but how much do they cost? And who can afford them? And what about people who can't? That seems to me a tragedy, or a tragedy beyond imagining. That is, if I remember William Moyers telling me, he walked in and they said, you know, well, he had cancer, he had a melanoma, and they said your treatment is completely covered, but when it came to his addiction treatment, he had to have the resources of his family to get the treatment. So how crazy is that? How crazy is the fact that we have this disease, this we know it's a disease. We've known that for 50 years, 60 years. Huh?
Well, and I mean, our country isn't the only, you know, isn't the one that always has all the answers. And I know that in my travels and some years ago, I met with and listened to the what's considered the drug czar of Holland speak, and he said pretty much the same thing as far as what you just said. You know, that, you know, they've legalized certain things. They're using their resources differently in how to deal with it. And it's a much bigger thing than we can discuss in the show right now. But what I'm saying is that you're not alone in your, you know, in your approach to how we should be handling this. You know, I've got an email here that has come across, and this actually came across before the show, and I'd love to read it now. It says, it is refreshing to see how it is refreshing to see a show on spirituality. In what I have read on Alan's site, you approach the topic in a very experiential way, which is very different than, quote, religion. The day-to-day way we just live in a joyful and grateful attitude, not a sinful, fearful old paradigm. I have ordered your book and look forward to reading and sharing it.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I thought that was very nice. And again, I thank everybody out there that takes the time. I know everybody can't listen at exactly this time, so I appreciate those that send in questions or comments that we can read on the air. And also know that for those that can't listen live right now, but you can listen later, you can subscribe to us free through iTunes and listen to the show after work, and still be able to hear the great things that Kathy and many others that come on the show share with us. So, you know, one of the things, you know, again, having read some of the books, share with us where your stories come from.
Oh, okay. So this is, I think humility is absolutely called for here. Ernie Kurtz is the keeper. I call him the keeper of the stories. So he has collected these stories over a lifetime of 7+ decades. And he has brought them to me. He has taught them to me. And so every once in a while, I will find a story that I could bring to Ernie. But really, they're his. They're his stories culled from many, many years of academic work and then just reading, and thinking. And so those stories are such a treasure, and I have files. I have the files called Ernie's Stories and Ernie's Old Stories and Ernie's New Stories. He's amazing. He is such such an amazing human being, and I feel so privileged to have worked with him.
Well, I have another. This is an instant message coming across, and we just have a little bit of time. This one reads, I am a fourth grade teacher with great concerns about future generations. Their parents are, for the most part, in survival mode or preoccupied, leaving the responsibility of their children to the school system. I do my best to live and teach by example with my own brand of spirituality, but I can't compete with the Miley Cyruses of the world as a role model. I would really like your view on where you believe we are headed.
Oh, well, I think she taps into a really deep place, which is that parents feel a little lost about how to deal with their children, and they leave that responsibility up to the schools and to the teachers. And then the teachers get the blame when the child doesn't perform. And I think that as parents and as human beings and as citizens of this vast, wonderful community that we live in, that we have to realize that we're all doing the best we can. And we have to not put the blame anywhere, put the responsibility anywhere. We all have to pitch in to do our role. And I think parents, I think there is some truth to the fact that parents ask schools and teachers to do the job that they wish that they don't know how to do. And I've talked to so many school teachers and administrators who say, our job is to teach. It's not to raise these children. It's to teach. And so I think that schools are being asked to do what they cannot do. And I think that parents have to back off a little bit from that idea of perfection to get back to the idea of imperfection.
Uh-huh.
Your child is not going to be, I mean, chances are really, really good that your child is not going to be the next Einstein or the, you know, premier graduate of Harvard, you know, or Princeton. Love them just the way.
Oops, are you still there?
I'm still here. Okay. Love them just the way they are, and give your teachers, give the people who teach them the greatest respect that you can, because they are doing their darndest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, I'm a big fan of teachers. I'm a big fan of the fact that I believe our teachers, are underpaid, and that's a whole nother show. I can't believe that we have ran out of time. Kathy, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate this. Really appreciate all the books that you've written. Again, for anybody, if you would like to find these books, you can go to www.catherineketchumbooks.com or experiencingspirituality.com, or just go to our website, answers4thefamily.com. We have all of Kathy's information there. Kathy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Alan. It was wonderful.
Thank you. And for everybody else out there, stay with us for just another minute. I want to tell you a little bit about a seminar that's coming up. For those that that don't know, I belong to a group that the International Human Trafficking Task Force, and one of our directors, Dottie Laster, is doing a training. And let me tell you, she is one of the top people in the world as it relates to training people in how to identify where human trafficking is and what to do when you find it. So, again, if anybody would like more information, you can also go to our website to get it, or this particular seminar is coming up. It's going to be in Los Angeles at Occidental College. And if you go to bernardkohler.org, it's bernardkohler.org, bernardkohler.org. You can get more information. This is going to be Tuesday, September 30th, and Wednesday, October 1st. I highly recommend it. Anybody that wants to make a difference in that field, go to the website, or just look up Dottie Laster, and you will see that she is doing incredible things throughout the world to help fight human trafficking. For everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Marvin Smith, right here on LA Talk Radio.